Hello and welcome to the Fermat's Last Theaters podcast project. My name is David Simmons, and I'm here today pleased to be speaking with Mark Silberman, the Emeritus Professor of German at UW-Madison, where he has taught since 1988. Mark has also been a guest professor at UCLA, universities in Berlin and Freiburg, the University of Oxford, and Hebrew University, and he is the author of many books, monographs, and papers about Bertolt Brecht and his works. And he is the curator of the Brecht in English Digital Archive, which is housed here at UW-Madison. Mark has also advised us in our ongoing Brecht project, including last fall's radical adaptation of Mother Courage Alone, the merits of which are mostly his, the faults perhaps ours alone. Thanks also to Sabine Gross and Hans Adler for their help with the talkbacks and with our Kafka adaptation of The Trial in 2016. Mark, hello and welcome.
Hello, I'm glad to be here and talking with you.
As I said to someone recently, for someone who is a professor emeritus, you are the busiest person I know, and you're soon to be off somewhere else.
That's right. I'm getting ready to leave for Spain as a guest professor at the Universidad de Valencia.
A good season to do it, given the snow outside here in Madison.
Right.
So describe for us the basics of Brecht's life and his evolving theories of theater for people who are not familiar with his work.
Okay, let me start with some basic facts. I mean, first of all, Brecht, certainly within the German-speaking context, is considered to be the most important dramatist of the 20th century. He was born in 1898 in southern Germany in the city of Augsburg in Bavaria. He died in 1956 at a rather young age, in fact, in East Berlin. After his exile in the United States, he settled in the German Democratic Republic because the communist authorities agreed to give him a theater of his own, which he thought was the best deal he could get after the 12 years of National Socialism. So he grew up in a kind of middle-class family, a bourgeois family in Augsburg. It was a mixed confessional family, which wasn't too usual at that time in Germany, a Protestant and Catholic family. He was a very good student. He went to a humanistic high school, learned languages. His high school education came to a somewhat abrupt end with the outbreak of World War I in 1914. He was still in school, involved in his school newspaper, wrote nationalistic patriotic poetry to support the war at the beginning. But as some of his friends were inducted into the military and he began to hear what was going on, he very quickly realized that the war was not something for him. He himself graduated from his Gymnasium, as it's called in German, the secondary education school, and went off to the University of Munich. His father wanted him to study medicine, so he matriculated in medicine, but didn't go to any of his medical lectures, went to the theater lectures instead, and he was actually kicked out of school. And at the very end of the war, he spent some months as a medical orderly in Bavaria, treating some of the soldiers who were being sent back from the front. That's where he had his closest encounter with some of the destruction of World War I. So after the end of the war, he was living a bohemian life in Munich. He got to know a number of the other young intellectuals, people involved in the theater, and he began writing his plays, the first of which was his famous play, Baal, about an outsider like himself, but a play that was targeting the kind of expressionist theater that was coming into its own on the German stage. He was writing an anti-expressionist play, parodying the kind of heroic qualities of the new man who was portrayed in these expressionist dramas. He wrote several more plays in the next couple of years. He won some prizes for his plays. He went to Berlin, and he was received with great enthusiasm there, finally settled in Berlin, and drew the attention of the theater world that culminated in the incredible success of the Three Penny Opera in August of 1928, a collaborative work, music by Kurt Weill. A lot of work was done on the transcription of the original English opera, The Beggar's Opera, by his friend and sometime lover, Elizabeth Hauptmann. That was a major success, probably the most successful play, music theater of the Weimar Republic, immediately translated into about 30 different languages, made the rounds of the European theaters, brought in a lot of money for Brecht, pretty much for the rest of his life, except during the years under National Socialism when he was unable to collect any royalties for it. But that really launched his career in Germany and to a certain extent internationally. He wrote more plays. He continued writing plays. By the way, he continued writing poetry and prose and essays as well. His complete works in German in the newest edition is 30 volumes, only 10 of which contain plays. So there's lots of other material that Brecht is known for. But with the ascension of the Nazis and their accession to power in March 1933, Brecht had to leave Germany immediately. He went initially to Switzerland, ended up, as many other intellectuals and people, Jewish people involved in any kind of artistic enterprise in Germany, ended up in exile for the next 12 years, first in Denmark when the war began and Germany walked into Denmark. He fled to Sweden and Finland, and ultimately he was able to get an entry visa for himself and his family, his wife Elena Weigel and their two children, to the United States. So traveling via Moscow and Vladivostok, he got on a ship that delivered him to California, settled in Los Angeles, that is in Santa Monica, where he spent the rest of the war years, 1941 until 1947, writing plays, trying to make an entry into Hollywood with very little success, I have to say. His biggest success was his collaboration with Fritz Lang on the film Hangmen Also Die. There were some smaller successes, but they hardly count as successes, I would say. His abrupt leave-taking of the United States was in 1947, October. He was called before the House Un-American Activities Committee, the Joe McCarthy Committee, because of the suspicion that he was a communist and he was supporting other communists and spies in the United States. So he was called before the committee. He didn't say anything very helpful. I think one would have to see his testimony at the committee as a typical kind of Brechtian theater piece, which we could talk about more if you want. But the day after his testimony, he climbed on a plane and went to Switzerland, stayed in Switzerland for a year and a half, where he was involved in two productions of plays of his. And then, as I mentioned, received an invitation to come to East Berlin, where he was given the opportunity to open his own theater called the Berliner Ensemble. And he became very active in the intellectual life of this socialist society, the German Democratic Republic. It was a vice president of the Academy of Arts, put on a number of plays, and ultimately died for medical reasons. He had serious bladder problems, and which led to cardiac problems, and he died of exhaustion in 1956, in August 1956. So those are the basic facts, maybe. What more would you like to hear about?
We'll come back to his politics, which is interesting. But let's talk about his conception of theater, because he was reacting against Stanislavski and some of the naturalistic theater that was then in vogue. Can you talk about what epic theater means?
Well, first of all, he wasn't reacting against Stanislavski until rather late, when Stanislavski became part of the cultural policies that he confronted in East Germany. Before that, Stanislavski wasn't really very important to him. In his initial interest in the theater, basically, he was against what he called the old theater, and he wanted to promote the new theater. He didn't yet call it the epic theater in the 1920s. In fact, that term comes up rather late in the 1920s and wasn't even defined by him. But he wanted what he referred to as a non-Aristotelian theater, which is the formal kind of structure of the naturalist theater coming out of the late 19th century German theater scene, and more importantly even, the kind of histrionic acting that dominated the German stage through World War I into the Expressionist theater. So these were the two things that he felt were deadening the theater and really making it impossible for any kind of new, more socially oriented theater, something that was addressing the problems of the current day. This is what he wanted.
So talk a little bit about what is sometimes mistranslated as the alienation effect or distancing. What did he want the actors to do that was different?
So what I call the estrangement, or I prefer using the German term Verfremdung, which comes from this German root fremd, which means strange, and therefore estrangement. He became interested in this because he felt that people going into the theater spent too much time trying to figure out what was happening on the stage. So one of the important innovations, if you will, of what became his epic theater was the idea that you let people know from the beginning what's going to happen. So they're not sitting on their edge of the seat waiting to see what's going to happen, but rather can look at the process of how a situation is constructed and how the actors are showing it to them. So you're not trying to figure out what's happening, you're trying to see how it's being shown to you. So this whole idea that theater is not the world, that theater is rather an artistic construct put on the stage for a certain reason, to show you something about the world, is probably one of the key concepts, I would say, it for the epic theater. Now, the estrangement, or the Verfremdungs effect, as I like to call it, this is another aspect of getting people to look at what's happening on the stage. If you keep presenting to people what they expect or what they know, then you basically lull them into a kind of consumerist attitude about what's going on. So by doing something that breaks that kind of fascination or identity with what's going on the stage, by making people say, wait a minute, that's not the way I would do it, or that's not the way I know it, it makes something unfamiliar. Another translation of this German word Verfremdung is sometimes defamiliarization. I think there's problems with that term. We don't have to discuss why, but it makes something unfamiliar, makes it strange so that you sit up and look at it and have to notice it. A lot of people have misunderstood the Verfremdungs effect as like a toolbox of techniques. You do this, and therefore that happens. Or you do that, and therefore something else happens. But I think if one looks at some of the numerous notes we have of Brecht's own theater work, going back to the 1920s, but up through the 1950s, the way he worked with actors, the way he wrote about how plays developed, the way they did, how his stagings developed, you can see that he was constantly searching for new Verfremdungs effects, new estrangement effects, because these have to grow out of the context, the history in which a play is being produced at a certain point in time. You can't use an estrangement effect from the late 1920s in a play you're putting on in 2018, because it's not likely to work. You have a different audience with a different experience in a different context.
I'll talk also about the difference between showing and telling, which was a part of his method.
Showing and telling. Showing is central to Brecht in his notion of what an actor should do and how actors should be trained, based on the idea that the best actor is one who is observant of life around him or her. You learn about behavior by watching people. And when you have really observed details of how people move, how people talk, how people react in all sorts of different kinds of situations, at work, at play, at a restaurant, in any kinds of situations, if you're observant of how people act and move and speak, then you can take on a role like that and show to other people, show to an audience how a certain behavior can be elicited and how two people together can communicate with each other. But this is something that in Brecht's view of acting and the training of actors has to come out of the actor's knowledge of the world around them, him or her. And so an actor who has been observant is able to show the results of that kind of observation. There are many tricks that Brecht used for doing that. One of the most familiar is that he asks, that this is not in the production of a play, but rather in working up a play, he would have an actor stand on stage and speak the role in the third person rather than in the first person. Stand next to the role he or she is playing and tell what the person is doing in the third person to get that outside of the identification with the figure in order to be able to see how that figure is a constructed figure and not something that really exists. Does that explain?
It does. It's it's very helpful, and it's different than other kinds of theater and different kinds of acting. But let's step back a bit and talk about his politics, because the thing that we're going to stage this summer is a devised work that centers around his testimony before the House on American Activities Committee. And he was a small C communist. He was a Leninist, he said. But he was never a member of the Communist Party. And that sort of got him off the hook in some ways, because they were looking for people, you know, who were members of the Communist Party or who had been members of the Communist Party and wanted them to name names of people who were. But Brecht put on quite a performance before HUAC, and then, as you said, left the country the next day. But he was a communist, and but at the same time, the cultural authorities in Moscow were somewhat skeptical of what he was doing,
to say the least.
And he saw many of his friends and compatriots disappear into the gulag or even worse, be shot in the purges and the show trials. But he did believe in the class struggle. He did believe in socialism, and that's why he left the country the next day, I take it, because they were very difficult times for people who were of that political persuasion. Is there more to be said about his politics? I mean, did they evolve once he got to East Germany? Because, I mean, he was in a socialist system there. How did the main work that he staged, which was Mother Courage, how was that viewed by the authorities in East Berlin?
Oh, David, there's a lot that can be said about Brecht's politics and the evolution of those politics. Maybe we should start kind of more at the beginning.
Okay.
I mentioned that as a school student, he was actually rather conservative, patriotic, nationalistic as World War I got underway, which was not at all unusual for German youth at the time. I would say on into the 20s, he was basically a bohemian, an anarchist. That's certainly the case of that earliest play, Baal, and some of the plays that came after that. His introduction formally to Marxism, and by the way, I'm not even sure I would call Brecht a small C communist. He's an unorthodox Marxist, is the way I would characterize him. His formal introduction to Marxism was in the late 20s. He was in a circle of intellectuals, sociologists, philosophers in Berlin. And he began reading Capital under the instruction of a sociologist there, and again, an unorthodox Marxist sociologist. And he was fascinated with the explanations there, with the insights of Marx about class struggle, about class contradictions, the way Marx turned Hegel on his head. Brecht knew something about philosophy. He came out of a humanistic gymnasium, as I mentioned, in Germany. He didn't study these at the university, but this was the kind of thing that was being discussed in these highly qualified schools at the time. And he was also in the late 20s more and more interested in the actual politics that was going on in Berlin. Remember, this was the time when Germany was becoming polarized, 1928, 29, then the market crash in October of 29 in the United States, which quickly had an impact on Europe and Germany, collapse of banks, collapse of the stock market, you name it. And this led to very open tumultuous times in the streets in Berlin. And Brecht was involved with labor unions. He was involved, as I said, with intellectuals who were part of this, with other creative artists on the left. And this is when he began writing these learning plays. In German, they're called Lehrstücke, which were actually meant for young people, for labor unions, for internal discussions among people, using these small plays, these short plays, to catalyze thinking about violence, about death, about the cost of radical change in the society. Very different than his longer so-called parable plays, for example. But this is what came out of this initial interest in Marxism between 1928 and 1932, I would say. By 1932, with the consolidation of Stalinism in the Soviet Union, the introduction of a very orthodox cultural policy called socialist realism, the kinds of things that Brecht was trying to do in the theater in Germany were simply beyond the pale. That was considered avant-garde, bohemian kind of stuff, which didn't show the struggle of the proletariat gaining power and becoming communist. And so he, although he was involved with and knew people in the Soviet Union, Mayakovsky and other people in that circle, and went to Moscow to show his film, Kulawampa, and so on, he did not fit into this orthodox view of socialist realism. And that became a problem throughout his exile years then.
So his work was characterized as formalist.
That was later. The anti-formalism campaign in East Germany began in 1951, and he became, he was very much what should I say, victimized by that, if you will. That became a very big problem for him. It wasn't exactly defined in those terms yet in the 1930s, but he was seen as someone who did not toe the party line as defined in the Soviet Union in Moscow during the 1930s. And although he was part of an important exile literary magazine published in Moscow, the editors of that magazine, the German editors of that magazine who were in exile in Moscow, really resisted what Brecht was doing during his exile in Denmark.
Oh, that was Das Wort?
Internationale Literatur and Das Wort. He was involved in both of those exile journals, both of which came out of Moscow. So when Brecht returned to East Germany in late 1948 and settled there in 1949, his theater was opened, the Berliner Ensemble. He was probably the most prominent exile author who had gone into exile in the West to come back to East Berlin. And there was great suspicion on the part of the German communists who had been in Moscow and came back to East Berlin and ran things about anybody who had gone into Western exile. So other German communists like Anna Zegels, who was in Mexico, Leon Feuchtwanger, who was in Los Angeles, Arnold Zweig, who went to Jerusalem and was very unhappy there, they all were interested in going back to East Germany, which they saw as the better Germany, the communist Germany. That was their future. The last thing they wanted to do was to go back to Adenauer, West Germany. But they were constantly under suspicion because they had been in the West. And if you trace this in Czechoslovakia, in Poland, in Hungary, there were lots of trials against other communists in those countries who, for whatever reasons, had also spent time in the West and didn't quite get that far in East Germany, but they were on the verge of that. So Brecht, as you mentioned, the first play he staged himself in his new theater, the Berliner Ensemble, was Mother Courage and Her Children, a play that used many of the techniques that we were talking about, the estrangement, Verfremdungseffekt, using interesting lighting techniques, using all sorts of these kinds of epic qualities that he had been writing about while he had been in exile. This play fell victim. It was put on in 1949. By 1950-51, it was seen as the main example of formalist theater. That is, the unacceptable kind of Western formalism that was becoming actually state policy of the CIA, which is another story we won't get into here, but which had become kind of abstract expressionism and another kind of theater that was promoted in the West by other groups.
Mother Courage is the play that we radically adapted, as I said, for one actress, one narrator, and one musician. And
very unusual approach, I have to say.
It certainly was, but it fits our means, which are slender. The way we did it was we had the narrator speak the prefaces of the play, which basically are spoilers. The narrator told the audience what was going to happen, and then they watched it. We thought that was Brechtian. I hope it was.
Yeah. And they see the twist and the turns of Mother Courage and hopefully draw some conclusions about her behavior, that she's making wrong decisions. She's blind. She can't see beyond the end of her own nose.
Right. So what would you say to Brecht's legacy? I mean, he certainly didn't establish a school which lives on in the way that other playwrights have done. What is the influence of him on playwrights who came afterwards and audiences who came after?
Well, it's very different from country to country, language to language, culture to culture. Let me summarize quickly what I see in Germany, which is a particularly interesting case because for 40 years you had a divided Germany, and Brecht had, certainly during his lifetime, those last 7 years or so in East Germany, a rather tense relationship with the authorities. But once he died, of course, then he became an icon of East German theater. But within East German theater, his Berliner Ensemble continued to put on his plays. He had a group of actors there that he had trained, dramaturgs and directors. They continued to put on his plays. But by the end of the 1960s, it had become basically a museum of old Brecht productions, completely counter to the idea of Brecht's epic theater, that plays have to be restaged and remade for a new audience and new times. Things change. You can't, for 15 years, keep doing the same play. So there was a crisis at the Berlin Ensemble. They brought in a new director in 1970, a woman, Ruth Berghaus, very creative woman who shook up things at the Berlin Ensemble, brought in Heiner Müller, who probably is the most famous student, if you will, of Brecht, although he never studied with Brecht, but he's the one who has adapted Brechtian theater ideas probably most consistently. He did some very interesting work at the Berlin Ensemble in the early 1970s, had his own problems there. By the end of East Germany, when the wall came down in 1989, the Berlin Ensemble was really a mausoleum. Mm-hmm. It wasn't doing much that was interesting. Mainly tourists were going to the theater. In the West, Brecht had a hard time in the 1950s because he had settled in East Germany. Right. So there was really almost an official boycott of Brecht in the West, especially in the more conservative cities where the Christian Democrats were in power. They did not allow their state theaters to put Brecht plays on. But nonetheless, there were some very interesting productions in the second half of the 50s. Some of them done, remember, the wall didn't go up until 61, so there was exchange going back and forth. Some of the directors Brecht had trained at the Berlin Ensemble actually did very interesting productions in West Germany, still in the late 1950s. By the time the wall went up, there was a situation where theater critics in West Germany were talking about a Brecht exhaustion, that too many plays had been put on and they were tired of it. They were looking at the absurd theater coming in from France and, you know, other kinds of things, Grotowski and so on. Brecht was old hat by that time. So by the end of the 1980s in general, Brecht had become part of the canon, both in West Germany and in East Germany. Everybody read Brecht in the schools, his short stories, at least two plays by him. By the way, that tends to be the case still today in the United Germany. Brecht is really part of the accepted canon by now as the most important 20th century German dramatist. The rest of the world has a much more delayed introduction to Brecht, I would say. Brecht was basically unsuccessful in the United States while he was here from 1941 to 47. He never really got into the theater. There was an attempt to put on a number of his plays. None of them got off the ground. It wasn't until George Tabori, the Hungarian director who had emigrated to the United States, when he did Brecht on Brecht in Philadelphia, and then in New York City in 1962, that was really when Brecht took off as an important force in the theater. There had been the Threepenny Opera production in 1954, which became the longest running musical on Broadway, but that didn't seem to go beyond that one play in the 1950s.
Plus, that version was somewhat cut, and And it wasn't until, I think, the 70s that it was revived with a full text.
Right, yeah. Right. But it was really that Brecht on Brecht, that potpourri that George Tabori put together in 1962, which introduced poetry, songs, scenes, some discussion about theater theory, where Brecht really was on the radar then. And that, of course, fed into the more general, what should we call it, an awakening in the 1960s, a cultural ferment in the 1960s, which was going on in many urban areas. The theater was part of this. Brecht became part of that whole reception then in the United States. England had a different response to Brecht. Remember, the Berlin Ensemble traveled to London in 1956. Brecht died in August of 56, and the Berlin Ensemble left for London 2 weeks later with their Galilei production. They had been to Paris twice in the 1950s, won enormous respect prizes in Paris during their two guest performance tours there. So the European reception of Brecht, also the work in Milan with Strehlau on the Three Penny Opera, introduced Brecht much earlier during Brecht's lifetime already to the Italian audience, the northern Italian audience. So Latin America is another story, the way Brecht moved it to Latin America. Augusto Boal in Brazil and Peru and Argentina, they all have their own reception histories. And actually in Latin America today, Brecht is pretty much on the agenda.
Really?
Yeah.
So here we are in March of 2018, and the University Theater is doing a production of The Resistible Rise of Arturo Uy.
One of many theaters in this country doing an Arturo Uy production this year.
That for some strange reason resonates with the time. Oh, well, Mark, thank you very much for your time and for your advice and support of From Mass Last Theater. We are deeply appreciative and wish you the best of luck.
And I look forward to your HUAC project.
All right. Will you be back in July?
I'll be back in July. Early July.
Okay, well, we'll be in touch. Thank you very much.
Yeah, you're welcome.